Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Hey, can you stay a little longer? Then? That's very good. So, yeah. So, good, good. Wonderful. So, I thought today we'll start with the real topic, you know, subject. So, what I thought today we can cover a very important topic of Bhakti Yoga. And that topic is two dimensions of bhakti. No? One is called parabhakti and second one is called aparabhakti. Aparabhakti. Para means highest. Supreme, you know. And bhakti means love, devotion, you know. Apara means not supreme, not the highest. That means the lower form of bhakti. So these are two major divisions of bhakti. Just as when you study the Yoga Sutra, there are two kinds of vairagya, non-attachment, dispassion. Para vairagya and apara vairagya. Highest vairagya and lower form of vairagya. In the Yoga Sutra, vairagya, the non-attachment is described based on its progression in our practice. That how you disentangle yourself, how you let things go which are bothering you, which are, you know, serving as an obstruction, you know, on your path. And how do you know that how far you have reached in terms of disentangling, you know, from the ropes of bondage? Based on that, the Yoga Sutra talks about lower forms of vairagya. That means that form of vairagya, non-attachment, dispassion, letting go, refers to a process, a journey. And as you complete a certain segment of journey, you can clearly see some signs and symptoms of your progress along the road. Let's say you are going to New York City, starting from Hansdale, northeastern Pennsylvania. Right in the very beginning, suddenly you noticed that your car is no longer moving. It just stopped. If you are able to drive from here all the way to, let's say, Hansdale, which is only 7-8 miles from here, you get a very good idea of your car, that it is functional. There are signs and symptoms of your vehicle which tell you that this vehicle is capable of taking you all the way to New York City. You get a very good idea. Also, you see how much the gas is there. If you have some understanding that how far distances, how much is the distance from one gas station to another gas station, and therefore should you fill it now, or, you know, all those preparatory steps are quite well understood. And if something you did not know, you will come to know. Your red light is not working. No? Your blinker is not working properly. Or your windshield is not doing well. Or your antifreeze liquid is frozen. No? Based on that, you make a certain decision. Quite often, starting point is always very crucial. Right in the very beginning, you come to know that your battery is dead. Once the engine starts running and you are driving, then there is less possibility of your battery to die. But right in the very beginning, you are trying your best and there is no ignition. There are lots of things become clear right in the very, very beginning stages of your journey. After that, there are some standard procedures, standard things. As you continue your trip, you are consuming gas. You need to go to the bathroom once in a while here, there. You got a detour and therefore you have figured out how to come back to your main path, main road. So that is, and then thereafter, you know, these are few things that you have to keep in mind. Right? If you have good GPS, if you have good map, you will figure it out. Even if you took some wrong turns here and there, it will be just fine. And some standard procedures are there, which everybody knows, and just a matter of following it. Don't, you know, speed up. There is a certain signs you watch, here you should drive slow, here you should ride at such and such a speed. And it is only when you are just about to enter the city, then you realize that lots of things are happening. So much activity is right before Lincoln Tunnel or Holland Tunnel or George Washington Bridge. So much is happening there. And even much more starts happening right before you just exactly find the spot within the city. You are supposed to go on such and such address. That's where you need very refined kind of vigilance and knowledge. And the thing is, everything was so perfect. Before you reached Lincoln Tunnel, for example, everything was perfectly on time. How many things can be unpredictable there, you have no idea. Because literally tens of thousands of people are doing the same very thing which you are doing. So there is a procedure when you are practicing, quote, non-attachment, and you have to follow it. It is called apara vairagya, lower vairagya, but it is just a term. It never means, well, if it is lower vairagya, then why should I practice it? I will go for, you know, the best one, highest one. It's not your choice. If you are, you have lower quality mind, you know. You have lower quality nose. For no reason it starts sniffing where it's none of your business. You know? You have lower quality ears. There are thousands of sounds, noises. You sit in your meditation, you are constantly thinking of, is it a noisy place? I don't like noise. You know? And there is very good, there is very good reason for you to be mad at the wind. Because the wind is blowing too much and it's creating bizarre kind of sound. You are mad at heating system. When the heat starts flowing, the metal expander, cut. You know? So when you have a lower quality mind, you are bound to have lower quality senses. And therefore you are bound to be distracted by lower quality distractions. Therefore it's very difficult for you to practice higher quality vairagya, non-attachment. It's the quality of your body, quality of your mind, quality of your belief system, quality of your value system determines which path is best. It's not the particular path is higher or, you know, inferior or superior or higher or lower. It's your compatibility with a particular path that determines which path is, you know, relatively more appropriate for you than the other. And then finally comes a, not a process, but rather a state when you are like such a wonderful Teflon-coated pot that nothing sticks to you. At that time, practice of non-attachment, for example, is really very effortless. And especially when that vairagya is accompanied by knowledge, understanding, then it's great. There could be a good number of, there are people, those who look like Teflon-coated pot, that, but the starting, the raw material, the raw ingredients of that Teflon is very low quality. No. There is, due to denseness, a buffalo is extremely fearless. He stands right in the middle of the truck. He's coming on, and the buffalo with eyes half closed. And the poor truck driver, you know, honking, the horn. And maximum buffalo does, that there are some flies sitting near its tail, so with the tail, it just drives, you know, removes the flies. That's all. So he's more concerned about the flies than the truck which may hit her. No? That's the state of fearlessness, non-attachment of the buffalo. No? Water buffalo I'm talking about, not Buffalo City. So here, this is bhakti. We are talking about trustful surrender. That constitutes the core of bhakti. And it is on that foundation you are arranging a structure called love and devotion. Now, love and devotion to who? Number one. And how do you put your idea of love and devotion into practice? When you start your love relationship with somebody, there is a process. You met someone. Somehow you feel that there is some chemistry. There is some compatibility. The way you look at each other, the way you talk, the way you, you know, express your willingness to share your salt shaker and black pepper. That has some meaning. It tells you, no, that yes, it will be my great pleasure. Please, like to have salt, no. So I know, for example, about some resident, that whether there is a need for salt, sprinkling salt on the food or not, she sprinkles it. So I have to start a conversation. I just extend the salt. Hi, Radhana, do you like to have salt? Oh, thank you. And she takes it. I know her. Even if she is in kind of withdrawn kind of mood, I know that the salt will work very well. And all we need is just a starting point. Thank you. As soon as she thank you, yeah, most welcome. I have catch up to, no, thank you. So there's something I know about her. And we extend. In general, we are human beings. We are familiar with certain, you know, a certain behaviors that all human beings share in common. Based on that, we act in a particular manner, we react in a particular manner. And this way, we express our love and hatred likes and dislike, and friendship and animosity, good and bad. Our willingness to be part of each other or unwillingness to be part of each other. There is a language, there is an expression. What is there with our love and devotion to the higher divinity? There is a standard process of expressing our love and devotion, likes and dislikes. And there is very special ones. With that, we are trying to explore more than, little bit beyond our known territories and get closer, get closer, get closer. It is a process. That process is called apara bhakti, the second one, quote, lower form of bhakti. We know very little about the object of our love and devotion, and yet somewhere in the back of our mind we have an understanding, or at least we have willingness to explore that higher divinity, higher reality, and its relationship with us. Based on that, we try, we start. Now, the way we are starting, it's subject to the culture of that particular time, belief system, and anything that has become an integral part of our mindset, psyche. So, people in Bengal express their love and respect to their divinity by offering food which normally consists of fish. You can't do puja, ritual worship to God and Goddess in Bengal without offering fish. In Judeo-Christian tradition, I think Judaism also, but definitely I have known about Catholicism, the offering of wine is an integral part of their worship. In many, many other cultures, they have many other things. Certain culture, they have water and the flower and incense and the flame and many, many other ingredients. Somewhere emphasis on those worship ingredients goes on food, somewhere on the natural objects which are also beautiful looking and have no so-called practical value, but they have great value in terms of rituals. In some other places, the objects which have practical value, which are edible, which are wearable, they offer such things. And somewhere, it's the color is very important, not the practical component of it. So in Tibet, they give you a scarf, normally a scarf, which you can never use it. Right from the very beginning, every strand of the scarf starts falling apart. It's long scarf. They give you as a sign of respect. They offer it to Buddha, and they offer it to the goddess Tara, and Vajrapani and Manjushri, and they offer it to you when you are a visitor, traveler, pilgrim, and if you go to a Buddhist monastery, and they greet you, honor you, they give you that scarf. It's extremely thin, and especially in the climate of Tibet, for example, it just doesn't make much sense. And yet that is somehow important. How it started, when it started, what was the purpose behind it, how it got associated with divinity, with sacredness, you know, sanctity. It must have some reason somewhere. But by the time we are trying to adopt, we may not see much value in it, especially when we are born and raised in New York City and one day we visit Lhasa, you know, and suddenly totally different culture. There is only one option. You just force yourself. It is His Holiness Dalai Lama does it, and therefore that's how it should be done. Finished. Now watch, you know. Because His Holiness Dalai Lama does it, therefore that's how it's supposed to be done. So the basis for your this practice is not your understanding, but His Holiness Dalai Lama. Now, look at, there could be very many reasons why you think that way. His Holiness is the 14th Dalai Lama. 13th? 14th. 14th. It's very, overwhelming kind of feeling to know that someone has come here to this world 14 times and he knows that he has come here 14 times and he has been in the same very position starting from somewhere in 13th century up to this day. There is a continuation of this soul's existence. Even if His Holiness Dalai Lama has learned about his spirituality and have gained experience at the same very speed which any dullest person on the face of earth experiences, still he got to be much better than many of us, most of us. Okay? 700 years, if you did nothing but just simply the alternate nostril breathing, it tells us something. It's something very unique. You know, many of us, you know, have a hard time sticking to our alternate nostril breathing for more than a couple of weeks. And we want to have vacation from our alternate nostril breathing. And His Holiness has been incarnating, you know, and doing his prayers and is concerned about Tibetan people's, you know, welfare. That is something very startling. One concept, this one single concept pertaining to him, for example, is that he has been here 14 times, 13 times before, this is 14th one. That's very wonderful. So it means you have gotten some very unique way of looking at the unknown, unseen. Somewhere you have already gotten the idea that there is something which does not require to be seen, perceived by through your senses. Sense of seeing, tasting, touching, smelling. There is something you can comprehend. Or there is a truth that lies outside the domain of our ordinary five senses, cognitive senses. That is, here you can clearly see that this is very, very, very unique knowledge. And of course, this knowledge was possible only because you are already free from, to a great extent, you are already free from suspicion, skepticism, and most importantly, hatred. If you have any significant amount of hatred, not just hatred toward anybody, a particular person or thing, just hatred in general, You would not be able to just consider someone to be a good, reliable, trustworthy person whose lifestyle or teachings can be taken as an exemplary thing. Your own inherent element of hatred, affliction, which is called affliction, dvesha, could have put a quite thick layer of veil on your intelligence, and to you, the Dalai Lama is just a fellow who is fighting for his Tibetan agenda. And not even Tibetan, if you are a little bit one step further in terms of your understanding of the world, then you would say, Dalai Lama is a person who is anti-China, who is leader of anti-China movement, not pro-Tibetan. Your mind, if you don't have too much pro within yourself, in first thing, if you are a shrewd politician and has good, powerful political spectacles, political lens through which he sees the world, then in that case, in the case of that particular individual, Dalai Lama forget whether he is even spiritual, non, that idea will not come in the mind, that even he will be not even a politician who has pro-Tibet agenda, because according to politician, nobody has any agenda. Even our Mr. Netanyahu, who comes and makes a bold statement right here in the White House that he strongly opposes the formation of Palestinian state. And politicians know that these things are just useless nonsense talk. So as soon as he wins the election, and up to this moment, President Obama has not made a telephone call, congratulation call. That means something. Right after he wins this mind, this fellow is now changing his entire statement. As though if the entire media and the entire 1.7 billion, this all 7 billion people are deaf and blind. He's changed it. So a politician is like that. Now, that kind of politician will not see Dalai Lama as a pro-Tibet, but he will see Dalai Lama as anti-China. Now, whereas you saw Dalai Lama, he offers his scars. This is how it should be done. It reflects a certain significant degree of purity of your heart, simplicity of your mind, in a non-wiggly, non-complicated way of looking at the world. Somewhere deep down, you are already familiar what you are looking for, what you should be looking for, let's put it this way. You really don't care much about too many things. You are trying to see and understand with a quite clear, in a quite clear manner, with quite clear understanding. You want to grow. You want to simplify your life. You want to find your connection. Good people are good people. What bad people are, let's put it aside. Where do I have time for all that? But at least if I can see goodness somewhere in good people and good things, that is a very big accomplishment. His Holiness is wonderful soul. Around, let's say, how many years? 1959, so 40 years, and then 15 years here. 64 years have gone by. And 54 years is a long time to hide your ill intentions and negative behaviors. And His Holiness so far has not shown any negative behaviors up to this day. And there's good reason to consider this man to be a spiritual person. You know, you can put on a persona, a mask on your, on the face of your mind. One day, 2 days, 1 year, 2 years, and at some point it becomes unmanageable, horrible. It's like you are carrying such a humongous burden of being flaky and hypocrite. And sooner or later, in your thought, speech, or action, it begins to reflect who actually are, who you are. Your true nature finds its own way, to manifest, to exhibit its truth about itself. Therefore, here is how this lower form of bhakti, apara bhakti, walks into our life. And yet it has limited scope. But the good thing is, it helps us get started. God is not homeless person or person suffering from shortage of clothes whom you must offer in order to please, whom you must offer clothes. God is not hungry. Therefore, it's not that if you don't offer Him sweets or things, He will be mad at you. God is not driven by His vanity. No. His self-identity is not really shallow and confined. If you worship Him or her while following Hindu cultural practices or Christian cultural practices, and I'm using the word cultural practices. We bring our cultural practices into our faith system. And by using those cultural practices as building blocks of our, theology, ideology, we create a structure. This is everywhere, in every culture, throughout the ages. It's not a new phenomena. And yet, it has value in our small little limited world. It gives us an opportunity to start. And that is how these different gods and goddesses have come into play. But we are human beings with some limitations. We are working so hard to rise above racism, for example, which in modern times makes us feel, is it really that important? We are free people. But you can see how deep are these ideas, race, caste, color, and superiority, inferiority, complex based on your poverty level, prosperity level. Even the size of the body. I will be inferior kind of Panditji in India because I'm not big. My tummy, thank God I have at least little bit tummy to be noticed as Panditji in India, but still I don't have, my size of my tummy is not big enough to reflect the wisdom which Hindu cultural practices accept. I have to be big. I have to be slow. I have to walk very slow. I have to talk very slow. I have to sit in a manner that I have to have lots of pillows around me. None of those things are there. Therefore, according to lots of a large varieties of Hindu values, I'm not very, in the eyes of that culture, I don't look like Panditji. Okay. Now see here, how cultures are so amazing. And as far as spirituality goes, my God, I'm 0% spiritual person. Because I don't have any sign of spirituality on my forehead. Neither I have a beard, nor pointed hat, nor big tummy, nor a flowing robe. You know, I'm not chewing, you know, what do you call this, betel nuts. You know, my lips and my teeth are not colored. You know, with the saliva, the colorful saliva. So none of those things are there. So it's a cultural. Clothes. My clothes are neither red, nor white, nor yellow color. Yellow color is brahmachari. White color is, tells you how pious you are. And red one is, of course, how unattached you are. These three qualities out of my appearance. On top of that, I don't carry my gods and goddesses and their pictures wherever I go. No. So what does it mean? This is something very cultural. Somewhere, God's house has to have shikharam, shikhar. This long, you know, pointy tower just keeps going up, 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 up in the sky. And of course, many people. There are books even have been written that this is symbolic of such and such. It points the height, straightness, God knows, touching, kissing the sky. That's why it represents such and such. Masks have to be designed differently. Churches have to be designed differently. Shinto shrines have to be designed differently in order to be perceived spiritual. So see here, we follow a system. Is it necessary? No, it's not necessary. On the other hand, yes, it is very necessary. You start your practice in Japan, China. You know, your search begins somewhere in a Shinto kind of atmosphere. Starting point is that you don't have much choice. These many of these cultural, so-called socio-cultural, spiritual elements existed before we were born. And there are hardly parents out there who raise their children as pure slate, clean slate. In fact, majority of the people in the world feel that it is their spiritual duty and responsibility to make sure their children grow in a spiritual way. Their children are exposed to spirituality. And that exposure to the spirituality means whatever the parents think of to be spiritual, that is spiritual. And thus, by the time you are 5, 7, 10, 20 years old, 15 years old, you are quite set in a particular ideology. And even at some point in our life when we kind of come to realize that it wasn't so correct, quite often we become rebellious. And we completely shut. We completely disconnect ourselves. We go totally 180 degree other way around. Then we explore something new and different. But no matter where we explore, everywhere, the culture out there has its own unique character. Therefore, it is very, very, very difficult to get out of this so-called bhakti, lower bhakti type of search. Because our mind is molded that way, senses are molded that way, our belief system is molded that way. And it is, you know, within that mold we are trying to find. Now in bhakti yoga, there are some standard way of looking at bhakti. And I should focus today here, and then we'll go to the parabhakti. Normally in the scriptures, always they start with so-called best. It becomes very disheartening that I'm not getting it, you know. You come to realize that somehow it doesn't make much sense to me, or perhaps I'm not ready, perhaps I'm not qualified. That's how normally it happens. So, apara bhakti. So, I'm talking about lower bhakti, this one. It has many, many, many. So, let's say, one is called here, dasya bhakti. Dasya bhakti. Dasya means slave. Dasa. D-A-S-A. Dasa. Dasa means slave. Dasya means that which makes a slave slave. The essence of dasa. Essence of being dasa. That which makes the, you know, the element which allows you to find yourself as a slave, as a dependent, and always it is in relation to, you are slave only if there is a master. Otherwise this whole idea of slavery is gone. If there is no master, you cannot be a slave. So it's called dasya bhakti. Quite often, this is one of the very, very broad division of lower form of bhakti, the bhakti, you know, that how you start, oh Lord, you are my master, I'm your slave. You are my protector, you are my guide. Not even guide, there is not much sense of guide. A slave doesn't, you know, think that far. Slave is protection. You are my master, I'm your slave. Anything I have, it has come from you, and whatever I have, it belongs to you. You know, it is with your permission, and that I'm using it. And totally, it is up, totally up to you when you take it away from me. You are master, you have the right to do that. And the biggest thing a slave is concerned is safety, protection. Now, this is one of the most pervasive form of bhakti that you find. At least now let us focus in quote bhakti yoga. If you are looking at the Eastern things, although when you do a cross-cultural, you know, analysis, you know, study, you will find that this is across the board. It's not only very unique to so-called Indian subcontinent and the practice of love and devotion to Southeast Asian religions. It's everywhere. The divinity whom you are trying to worship, or divinity where you are channeling your love and devotion to, is your master. And somebody who is very close to the master is also, from your standpoint, is master too. Let's say if the master has 20,000 slaves, our understanding is that it is very, very difficult for the master to know and be aware of, fully aware of each and every slave. Our mind has difficulty even comprehending it. If you are a full-time master, and you have nothing else to do, perhaps you can keep track of a couple of hundred of your slaves a day. But keeping in touch with each and every 20,000 slaves and keeping all the minute details of those slaves, when the slave, what the slave eats, how much he eats, where did he go, when did he go to the bathroom, whether, you know, he picked enough cotton and whether he harvested enough sugar cane, you know, and whether he spent too much time with his wife and children. If master wants to keep, according to our mind, it is absolutely impossible for even the best and most genius and hardworking master to keep track of all the minutest details of those 20,000 slaves. Therefore, that master has to have some kind of system in place. There is a CEO of the slaves who manages the slave battalion. The managers, sub-managers, you know, divisional managers, it may go on and go on. It's like an institute. And master keeps in touch with the super boss. From your standpoint, if you are lower level slave, your boss is someone who is your supervisor, right little above you. That's how the idea of Swamiji comes. Swami. It's so shocking. See here, what I'm trying to tell you, that lower bhakti is kind of necessity and yet sometimes childish. And yet there is no way to escape it. It's a very, very solid, concrete reality. The word Swami came into existence just around 150 to 200 years ago in India. There is not a single literature in India before that ever mentions any Swami. There is no word Swami Sankaracharya. There is no word Swami Patanjali. There is no word like, this title doesn't exist until around 17th century, 18th century. That was the peak period of disintegration of Indian society, and every village had a Raja. Sometimes even the same village, there were a couple of Rajas, masters. So spiritual people also started calling them Maharaja. So when you go to India, and it is very puzzling to the Westerners. So people, you know, somehow, lately I don't know what has happened. I think people have given up on me. But people used to write, and even they used to ask me, I'm looking for a Sadguru. Are you Sadguru? Real Guru? No idea. Isn't that if you are Sadguru, you must know you are Sadguru? I said, my effort is these days, you know, I'm trying to know myself, whatever I am, without any bias of whether I'm Sadguru or bad Guru. Total person confused. In India, people go to India and then they start looking at big name. These are titles, like the more title. And here, you can't misuse. Even here in this country, there is a clear distinction, especially in Europe, in England, you know, a clear distinction between PhD and DPhil. Indian universities in India do not offer PhD degree. They offer DPhil, Doctor of Philosophy. The word Doctor of Philosophy is written DPhil, P-H-I-L, D capital Phil, DPhil. Whereas in this country, P-H period D, P-H-D, exactly the same thing. Okay, so it's title. In India, It would have been very inappropriate for me to write my degree PhD. Thank God now I have a real PhD too. I have a DPhil from India, which is in American English, PhD. And I have a real PhD, which is real PhD in American English. So I can reuse both. Because one is from India, one is from here. At least one will work in each country. You know? And it will be correct. So, title here is used very carefully. If you have this degree, you have this degree. If you don't have it, you don't have it. You know? Your laundryman, your hair designer, and your priest in the church, they are not allowed to, they are not supposed to give you a degree. But in a culture where it is taken just like so lightly, somebody calls you Maharaj, the great lord. Where is your kingdom, sir? Which kingdom do you rule that? And how many other kings are under you that you are paramount king? You know, king means Raja. And Maharaja means paramount king. Under you there must be many, many more kings. So you go there, in every ashram, there are a couple of, you know, hundred Maharaj sitting there. They are spiritual Maharajas. Okay. Then there are Jagat Guru, the guru of the entire universe. Then there are Mandaleshwar, the lord of whole Mandala, the whole region, and lord of Mahamandala, you know. If the entire India is divided, let's say, in 25 parts, Mahamandaleshwar, the Lord, Ishwara, you are Lord, you are God. Ishwara means God. Mandala means region, area. Maha means great region. You are Mahamandaleshwar. You are the creator and destroyer and provider and protector of this entire region. Whereas the truth is, you have a hard time, you know, managing your day-to-day life, but you are God. So the custom started. What was missing at that time? There was a society had become disintegrated. And it was extremely oppressive society. And almost everybody was oppressor, and everybody was being oppressed. And that had become part of the society in those days. And there was a need for being a swami of yourself, master of yourself. Some good degree of autonomy. Autonomy was missing from, you know, in life. And therefore autonomy was in great need. So here comes Swami. Some of the kings also started bearing the term Swami. That is how things evolve. So you are master or you are slave. In relation to the higher divinity, unknown force, whom we try to find, when we are in search of finding who is our creator, who existed before us, who has extraordinary power to, you know, free us from the bondage, from pain and sorrow. No. When we are trying to find out that, the first thing that comes in our mind, that it got to be much bigger, higher, more powerful, more intelligent than we are. And hopefully, it's not only just simply more powerful than I am, perhaps the most powerful ever. So always, you know, we are, as a people, as a person of limited knowledge, we hope to find somewhere and become connected to, have some good, healthy relationship with somebody who is not of that limited knowledge, but rather is omniscient. We have limited capacity to accomplished things. And there is a great joy in having someone whose capacities are not limited. Thus is omnipotent. And we are occupying limited amount of space. And the space is very amazing thing. Despite the fact that in one time we cannot cover a space more than what can accommodate our body. No matter what we do, we cannot own the space, because the size of our body is so small. It can occupy only the space which is, you know, of the size of our body. And yet, there is something amazing about occupying space and everything that gives room to others, you know, other things in that space. So we, big house, bigger car, no? Bigger office, bigger kingdom, just list goes on. That's what gives us, the more we have the ownership of the space, and that fits, and all the objects that can fit in it, we feel big. Our grandeur, our concept of being big, which all of us love, this nature of our asmita, I-amness, our self-identity. Our self-identity is tasmin mahati atmani avasthaya. That's what the Yoga Sutra tells us. That there is a very built-in kind of, you know, innate tendency in all of us to be big. To be big physically, hopefully, possibly. You know, Americans are, you know, everyone else in the world out there, especially in those countries where the size of the human body is smaller, Americans automatically are very respect. They don't need to be very smart. They don't need to be very rich. The size of your body is big, automatically you are a big man. You know? Petra can really scold any person in the Indian train. And nobody has capacity, nobody has courage even to, you know, disobey her. You know, whether the train is, you know, the seat in the train, she has the reservation of that particular seat or not. If she tells that person, excuse me, this is my seat. The poor Indian man is just, you know, of course, she's big, you know, she's telling me that it is her seat. So he just moves away. So, wow, this is called having nice, robust body. No? And Clarence walks on the road, you know, even the truck driver has to be very careful, you know, because he's walking tall man, you know, 7 foot tall. You know? And truck man knows that he's only hardly 5 foot tall. If Clarence does not need to be sitting on the, you know, steering wheel of the truck in order to be big. No, he's just a big man. Very amazing how mind works. You know? So our God has to be bigger than us, more intelligent than us, richer than us, more beautiful than us. Anything that we feel that we need, but somehow we do not have to our fullest, you know, satisfaction. God got to have all those things. That's why he's God. You know? And most important thing is, all of us are mortal. We are born and one day we die. And no one wants to die. Death is such a horrible thing. It takes away everything. No. Therefore, God is immortal. And that immortality is measured by us. It's measured by the yardstick of birth and death. There is an amazing joke which, you know, may not be politically correct even to tell you. But I know that you are yogis, you know, and you have been quite well grounded in the principle of forgiveness. So I can gather my courage and share with you. There is a joke based on some good degree of truth. And joke is, a sadhu, a spiritual man, always exaggerates his age. By the time a sadhu is 70, 80 years old, he stops telling how old he is. But rather, he takes a very big jump. You know? And all he needs to do is just lose his teeth and lose his hearing. Lose a little bit of his eyesight. Jaws drop. No. And if he's lucky, he can also lose his hair, becomes bald. Then after that, he doesn't have to tell how old is he. All he has to, hey, beta, ages have gone by. I remember when Abraham Lincoln was leading civil rights movement. At that time, I was living at the bank of Ganges. In those days, it used to take months and months before the news traveled from America to India. And it was so inspiring that I left Rishikesh. I came to nearby town just to see what this great soul was doing. So person will connect, you know. It means he was already, and then his students will add a few more years. He was already at that, during the time of Abraham Lincoln, he was already 80 years old. My Gurudev was 80 years old. That's the behavior of him. That's how the sadhu tells. Whereas a professional prostitute, other way around, she's 70 years old, and she spreads the news that she is, you know, is still in her, you know, upper 20s. So she reduces her age, and a spiritual, religious person in that culture adds to his age. Why is this? One has value for her, you know, youthfulness, and another has value for his wisdom, another, you know, the appearance of wisdom that comes with age. Because everybody is so short-lived. And if you are 100 years old, 120 years old, and if by chance you are revived after you are dead, and some by chance you got revived when already the fire was lit at your funeral pyre, and somehow miraculously somebody came and pulled you out where the fire was just about to, you know, burn some of your body, then you got to be very, very blessed. You know, some God just came, and this person who revived you was great. All these stories, where is it coming from? It's coming from what we desire to have, but we do not have. And it's great, great, you know, it's so exciting to attribute all those things which we are missing in life, attributing all those things onto something else, someone else. It's a great spiritual act. Quite often, therefore, it's not only God we are inclined to worship, but rather even those who are somewhat close to God, his lieutenants. I'm using a little bit less respectful language, but that is how things happen in so-called upper bhakti, the lower form of bhakti. You know, there is a God we worship. and sour, very, very preferred kind of God, with certain features, with certain attributes. And again, it is only when you are out of that, you are not part of that culture, or you are somewhat, your mental training, your intellectual training is somewhat different and has led you to reach somewhere else, then you probably think that it is very childish. But those who are born and raised in that environment, for them it's not childish. Ganesh does have a trunk. Hanuman does have it, you know, a tail. They are real people. They are real gods. And it doesn't make any, it does not appear to be very, very, bizarre or unreasonable for God to have a wife and have some children. You know? In that particular cultural context. You take the context out, then it looks very bizarre. And it even becomes more bizarre when some of the human limitations are also imposed. Example, Shiva. He lusted after the wives of some sages, and sages got mad at him. So they cursed him. As a result of their curse, Shiva's generative organ fell. It got dismembered. And all other gods, they said, oh my God, if it falls on the earth, it will just shatter the entire planet run. Now who can hold it? So people, all the gods and great, you know, souls, they prayed to Parvati, Shakti. And then she turned into female organ, and that's where she held it. And thus, here comes the practice of, you know, the worshipping Shiva as a lingam. And it's written in the books, and it's perfectly fine. Even you can imagine, just day or so ago, in Indian Parliament, in upper house, a parliamentarian shocked everybody when he raised the question, why Ganga came to the earth? It's really bizarre. It's all over in Indian newspaper and BBC. This is the top priority of the parliamentarians in India, to discuss this matter and settle down this matter that our mother Ganga river did come from heaven, and such king brought her, and therefore Ganga does not belong to a particular group because Ganga came from heaven and she was brought by this king. So amazing logic is being given, you know, and it's celestial river, and where all human beings, you know, have equal right to have her waters. Therefore, there, God knows what point he was making. It was very bizarre. So see, the point is that context is so amazing. That see, there are certain culture, it's not bizarre to have a god, male god, who got some distracted, and it's not bizarre that there are sages. God is being punished by sages. How does it sound to you? How does it sound to you? Here we are brought and raised in with kind of Christian theology where God is supreme. Do you really go and punish God and tell him, Mr. God, you really, this is totally inappropriate the way you are behaving, and here I'm going to teach you a lesson? It's inconceivable. In other cultures, somehow it's not. At least in a particular segment of society, it's not very bizarre. A reason is being given that how, reason for worshipping Shivalingam is given. This is the reason is being given. How convincing is this reason to you? At least it is not very convincing to me. You know? And if, because I'm born and raised in that environment, and somehow if it is not convincing to me and if I articulate it, then what will happen to me? I'll be ostracized. Is it worth my time discussing this matter and debating others? If I have anything better to do, of course, it's not worth my time. You know? So this way, lots of people like me, they don't bother to touch this point. And those who are not like me go on embracing the same very thing, which I don't feel even worth my time discussing the matter. So thousands of years go by, and these kinds of stories are repeated again and again and again, and it becomes part of so-called culture. Now you channel your love and devotion to God while embracing that cultural element. And you benefit from it. In that particular context, it is very real and it has value. It is allowing your mind to flow peacefully, gently toward higher divinity, from mundane to sacred. This is Dasya Bhava. Now, who is this Lord Shiva? As a Shiva Lingam, he is creator, destroyer. He is God. But somehow, no, he is destroyer more than creator. Creation is part of Brahma, maintenance is part of Vishnu, destruction is part of Shiva. That's how normally in our own personal life and household and companies, you know, we have our own jobs. You know? So, that's fine. You channel your mental shakti. Your process of purification begins. Your process of purification, concentration, and your process of, you know, you're feeling that space inside you, which is now either empty or already filled with something unwanted and undesirable. Now you take it, that unwanted and undesirable, out, and you fill it. You fill that space now with something which is desirable, which is positive, which is good, which is spiritually illuminating. It's called bhakti. Here, bhakti means love and devotion. And here, the thrust, the force that is pulling you in that direction is Dasya Bhakti. She is the Lord and I am the servant. Relationship is very clear and simple, straightforward. Within that structure, we are going through some pleasant experiences or unpleasant experiences in life. Some success, some failure. Some loss, some gain. Some respect, some insult. And this Lord of life, Master, is watching over us. Although I don't understand what's the whole purpose behind all these things which is happening to me. And yet, my Lord knows better. I am a sheep and a shepherd. This principle is called Dasya Bhakti. He is shepherd, I am his sheep. He knows better than me where the pack of wolves and tigers and other wild animals live. He will protect me. I must continue being a good sheep. I must not violate the rules and the laws established by him. I must not transgress. No transgression. All I have to keep in my mind, you know, in order to stay on this path of love and devotion and receive his love and protection, that I must not do any transgressions. What are those things which make him displeased, which displeases him? There are set of things that have been delineated. Why should I care? Why that we follow that which has been delineated? Who are those who delineated it? They are very close to him. They are very close to God. They know what were they doing. How do you know it? This is a question not to be asked. Why? Because if you keep asking this kind of question, there are so many millions of questions and most of them have no answer, your head will shatter into 1,000 pieces. You know? And that is, and this is not the time for your head to shatter. Better you keep it intact. No? At this moment, the urgency is to attain freedom from sorrow and its fundamental causes, so that you become a happier, healthier person. And so that you can complete the cycle of life, you know, productively. So that you can experience life as a reward rather than punishment. And after the life ends, you find place in the kingdom of God. That's called Dasya Bhakti, lower Vairagya. And this whole set of things have been done, have been written. How you practice it. Charity, purity, truthfulness, non-violence, and faithful to your church, temple, teachers, your prophets, your Messiah. And this is almost in every religion, not only Christianity or Hinduism, or it's almost everywhere. No. And then as you continue doing it, automatically there comes automatically you are in the process of purifying your mind and sharpening your intellect and purifying your heart, and therefore your comprehension level automatically increases. 10 years ago, you started as a completely perfunctory kind of, you know, system, where like a routine work, you know, a daily chore. You wake up in the morning, do this. Somehow it led you in such a wonderful manner that your comprehension level went up. Suddenly, your way of thinking and your way of seeing things have changed. That is called transformation. Your idea of God also, as soon as you become less complicated, less fearful, less doubtful person, and as soon as your level of your hatred and anger and, you know, fear declines, you know, automatically the virtues, positive virtues, start rising. It is in proportion to the decline of negative elements, and it is in proportion to the rise of your positive elements. Automatically, your thought process changes, your worldview changes, your attitude toward yourself and toward others change, and it is in same very proportion, your understanding of God and your relationship with God also change. You know, then you are not a timid slave of God. And God is not a scary master of yours. God is not a source of fear. You know? And you are not an object of submission. You know? But rather, it is great honor, great pleasure, it is great opportunity that he or she is my protector, giver and provider. And I am there, whom he loves so much. Your whole attitude changes. That is how you are moving, you know, on this path of Dasya Bhakti. You started wherever you are. You had lots of childhood scars, emotional injuries. You had lots of limiting, very, very delimiting kind of cultural and religious values when you started. You had very low image of yourself. Your image of yourself was very low. And it is in that context you started. But as you keep progressing, many of those things are left behind. Your self-image improved. Okay. Your childhood scars got healed to a great degree. Something got healed because you let it go. Something got healed because applied the principle of forgiveness. Something got healed because of the understanding that there must have been some unavoidable circumstance in which your mom, your dad, your uncle, your brother and sister behaved the way they behaved. Instead of being mad at them, suddenly you start praying for them. Oh Lord, don't please take away these kinds of circumstances where our own lovely parents and lovely kinsmen, where they hurt and harm each other, and in the process they themselves hurt and harm each other. So much pain they themselves carry. I'm aware of only my pain and how much pain they themselves must have gone through or must have been hiding. So your whole attitude changes. The goodness starts walking in your life. That is how you started with aparabhakti, and step by step by step you keep moving. So let me stop here, and then I will give you some other dasya bhakti. Then there are many, many other kinds of bhaktis. Just few more examples, I'll give you, and then I'll come to finally parabhakti. So perhaps next time also I'll give you a little bit more other forms of bhakti, where it's not only just dasya, we are servant, his master, but even something more. So thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you. Oops. Oh, wow.